住你。
大家好，这里是北京外语广播正在播出的大学生英语在线 Question of the Day， 我是米歇尔。米歇尔，今天我们跟我们一起分享秘密的嘉宾呢，依然是壮壮老师。
Yes, and our TED Talk today is under the title of Perspective is Everything.
啊，经常会说，比如说态度决定一切，这个决定一切，那个决定一切。这个发言人呢，他的标题就是 Perspective is everything，
是
角度，
视角，
对，视角决定一切。那么这个人的身份叫 Advertising Guru，
啊 ，Guru
大师。
对，这个 guru 这个词源于那个印度的，像瑜伽大师就叫 guru，
yoga guru，
什么上师啊，一般翻译成中文翻成上师。
guru 是我编的、
啊，但是我觉得那个 guru 吧，总让我联系
guru， 就是那个《指环王》里面那个 Gollum， 是吧？我想起来的那还不是咕噜，是雇佣。
哎呀，就是肉虫子向前移动的那个动作。
突然觉得自己有些高尚。
哎呀，还是你那个比较高大上哈。嘉宾叫 Rory Sutherland 啊，他是一个英音的讲话啊。他说 ：“The circumstances of our lives may matter less than how we see them.” Says Rory Sutherland at TEDx Athens. He makes a compelling case for how reframing is the key to happiness. 所以这一段呢是通往幸福之路的一个关键啊，是这个钥匙。也就是这个事情呢，其实对于我们来讲不是那么重要。
嗯，
重要的是呢，是我们如何看待一件事儿。
嗯。
我觉得这个我挺认同的，其实这个也算是老生常谈了。对吧，大家都说了，哎呀，困难或者怎么样，我读到这么一个小的故事，他就说在这个航海的时候呢，这个船遇难了，于是呢家里的这个丈夫呢就把这个救生圈往下这么一扔，自己就跳下去了，这时候呢把妻子留在了船上，那么妻子应该对这个丈夫喊出的这个话是什么内容呢？那米笑你觉得呢？
阴暗点的就是你给我回来，把船给我。好一点的是赶快去找人救我们去，赶快去求救去。
啊啊、你猜的一部分是贴谱了，对。
你给我回来，那是对的，是吧？
不是，还有人说算我这辈子瞎了眼，
我现在自戳双目，现在没瞎，立即戳瞎。
嗯，然后呢，再来呢，就是其实最后这个女的这个妻子说出了一句话是，请照顾好我们的孩子。
嗯。
那么大家在看这个故事的时候呢，就觉得第一了，这个老婆很是舍己救人，对吧？第二，这个老公也确实是毫不犹豫的就窜下去了，还是觉得有点不太厚道，这种感觉。可是呢，话又说回来，这两个人是怎么回事呢？其实是妻子已经患了绝症。所以说呢，这个就
只是告诉了我事情真相的一部分嘛，真是。
对，所以说我们。在做任何事情的时候呢，就是不要特别急的做出判断，一定要我们把这个所有的事实都搜集清楚了，是吧？ Make well informed decisions and judgments。好，所以这个呢，回到我们演讲要介绍的这一段，就是这个事情啊，你看它的角度完全是很主观的。那你这么看呢，当你不了解这个事实的时候，你去看这个老公跳到救生船上这个行为，你就会觉得
把
相当的
救生船扎漏，
对，让他去漏水
对
而亡啊。但是当你了解到了原来这个妻子已经患了绝症的情况下，你就觉得老公的这个行为是对的，是个正确的，
情理之中的。对，
所以说呢，大家在看待事情的时候，这个角度呢是很重要的。Perspective is everything。
要万一真是坏事，也是逼着我善良吗？难道？
所以说，
反正善良还是内心的安宁吧。
哎呦我的妈！你这都扯到哪里去了？
抑制不住，每次我喝了开水就会这样。
那就给你喝点凉水吧。
水已经凉了，现在天有点凉。
Okay. 所以说呢，这一段呢，我们除了在听内容上来讲呢，就是大家要思考哈。另外一个就是英音，我们学的许多的选段呢都是美音。你像这一块就是发言是发生在那个雅典，叫 TEDx Athens。Athens 是雅典，就是希腊了。是吧？然后呢，我们就看到世界各地的人，北京话说也有 TEDx 啊，叫 TEDx。我因为去坐同船，所以
你啥时候去讲一段吧？
那我讲
一段关于秘密的演讲。
不，我要讲，我就一定要讲我这个找保姆的经历。哎，话说这个找保姆的经历， 我讲完了之后，
写本书吧。
朋友们都说这个是很好的一个剧本的素材。
嗯，
啊，其实我觉得
我给你演保姆，
不用你演，
请让我演保姆吧。
哎，那个我见到的保姆呢，在家政公司登记的时候呢，
嗯、
就是。这个穿上这个黄色的工作服以后，他就准备拍照，然后放到网上这个 profile 上。
嗯、
然后呢，拍照的时候呢，家政公司的工作人员呢就说：“你别动。”他就把这个袖子抻直了啊，头摆正了。这个保姆不解，他就要动。然后说呢，一会儿我开始拍 video 的时候啊，视频的时候你就说三句话：“我叫什么什么什么，然后我来自哪里，然后我想找一份家政工作。”三句话。我叫张富华，我来自甘肃。这个甘肃这个版本是在校正了三遍才说对。之前他就说我来自北京，他说电视里都是这样的。
嗯，
说我来自北京，我要来找一份好工作。
嗯，
他电视看的就是很受这个媒体的影响。
嗯，
其实他可能潜意识里边他也是想往这个大城市这个都市化的这个生活上靠拢哈。咱们就说这个人呢，这个保姆呢，要是我呢，我不太敢用，因为呢 ，she doesn't have the ability to follow instructions。
嗯，
对吧？
是。
比如说我告诉你了，生案板用这个案板，熟案板用那个案板，他就不 follow， 他就给你对瞎用，因为他
肉刀切菜，嗯
啊，对，拿菜刀
切肉
是吧？然后呢，就很 feel frustrated。
对，
好，不管怎么样呢，就是咱们怎么又扯到保姆那儿去了呢？哈，
那我们还来听一下吧，
听
一下就回来了。
好，
好的。
What you have here is an electronic cigarette. It's something that, since it was invented a year or two ago, has given me untold happiness. A little bit of it, I think, is the nicotine, but there's something much bigger than that.Which is, ever since in the UK they banned smoking in public places, I've never enjoyed a drinks party ever again. And the reason I only worked out just the other day, which is when you go to a drinks party and you stand up and you hold a glass of red wine and you talk endlessly to people, you don't actually want to spend all the time talking. It's really, really tiring. Sometimes you just want to stand there silently, alone with your thoughts.Sometimes you just want to stand in the corner and stare out of the window. Now the problem is, when you can't smoke, if you stand and stare out of the window on your own, you're an antisocial, friendless idiot. If you stand and stare out of the window on your own with a cigarette, you're a fucking philosopher. So the power of reframing things cannot be overstated. What we have is exactly the same thing, the same activity, but one of them makes you feel great, and the other one, with just a small change of posture, makes you feel terrible. And I think one of the problems with classical economics is it's absolutely preoccupied with reality. And reality isn't a particularly good guide to human happiness.Why, for example, are pensioners much happier than the young unemployed? Both of them, after all, are in exactly the same state of life. You both have too much time on your hands and not much money. But pensioners are reportedly very, very happy, whereas the unemployed are extraordinarily unhappy and depressed. The reason, I think, is that the pensioners believe they've chosen to be pensioners, whereas the young unemployed feel it's been thrust upon them.In England, the upper middle classes have actually solved this problem perfectly because they've rebranded unemployment. If you're an upper middle class English person, you call unemployment a year off. And that's because having a son who's unemployed in Manchester is really quite embarrassing. But having a son who's unemployed in Thailand is really viewed as quite an accomplishment. But actually, the power to rebrand things, to understand that actually...Our experiences, costs, things, don't actually much depend on what they really are, but on how we view them. I genuinely think can't be overstated. There's an experiment I think Daniel Pink refers to, where you put two dogs in a box, and the box has an electric floor. Every now and then, an electric shock is applied to the floor, which pains the dogs.The only difference is one of the dogs has a small button in its half of the box, and when it nuzzles the button, the electric shock stops. The other dog doesn't have the button. It's exposed to exactly the same level of pain as the dog in the first box, but it has no control over the circumstances. Generally, the first dog can be relatively content. The second dog lapses into complete depression. The circumstances of our lives may actually matter less to our happiness than the sense of control we feel over our lives. It's an interesting question. We ask the question, the whole debate in the Western world is about the level of taxation. But I think there's another debate to be asked, which is the level of control we have over our tax money. That what costs us £10 in one context can be a curse. What costs us £10 in a different context, we may actually welcome. Pay £20,000 in tax towards health, and you're merely feeling a mug. Pay £20,000 to endow a hospital ward, and you're called a philanthropist. I'm probably in the wrong country to talk about willingness to pay tax. I'll give you one in return. How you frame things really matters. Do you call it the bailout of Greece or the bailout of a load of stupid banks which lent to Greece? Because they are actually the same thing. What you call them actually affects how you react to them, viscerally and morally. I think psychological value is great, to be absolutely honest. One of my great friends, a professor called Nick Chater, who is the professor of decision sciences in London, believes that we should spend far less time looking into humanity's hidden depths and spend much more time exploring the hidden shallows. I think that's true, actually. I think impressions have an insane effect on what we think and what we do. But what we don't have is a really good model of human psychology, at least pre-Kahneman, perhaps. We didn't have a really good model of human psychology to put alongside models of engineering, of neoclassical economics. So people who believed in psychological solutions didn't have a model. We didn't have a framework. This is what Warren Buffett's business partner Charlie Munger calls a latticework on which to hang your ideas. Engineers, economists, classical economists, all had a very, very robust existing latticework on which practically every idea could be hung. We merely had a collection of random individual insights without an overall model. And what that means is that in looking at solutions, we've probably given too much priority to what I call technical engineering solutions, Newtonian solutions, and not nearly enough to the psychological ones. You know my example of the Eurostar. £6 million spent to reduce the journey time between Paris and London by about 40 minutes. For 0.01% of this money, you could have put Wi-Fi on the trains, which wouldn't have reduced the duration of the journey, but would have improved its enjoyment and its usefulness far more. For maybe 10% of the money, you could have paid all of the world's top male and female supermodels to walk up and down the train, handing out free Chateau Petrus to all the passengers. You'd still have £5 billion in change, and people would ask for the trains to be slowed down. Why were we not given the chance to solve that problem psychologically? I think it's because there's an imbalance, an asymmetry, in the way we treat creative, emotionally driven psychological ideas versus the way we treat rational, numerical, spreadsheet-driven ideas. If you're a creative person, I think quite rightly, you have to share all your ideas for approval with people much more rational than you. You have to go in and you have to have a cost-benefit analysis, a feasibility study, an ROI study, and so forth. And I think that's probably right. But this does not apply the other way around. People who have an existing framework, an economic framework, an engineering framework, feel that actually logic is its own answer. What they don't say is, well, the numbers all seem to add up, but before I present this idea, I'll go and show it to some really crazy people to see if they can come up with something better. And so we artificially, I think, prioritize what I'd call mechanistic ideas over psychological ideas. An example of a great psychological idea, the single best improvement in passenger satisfaction on the London Underground per pound spent came when they didn't add any extra trains nor change the frequency of the trains. They put dot matrix display boards on the platforms. Because the nature of a wait is not just dependent on its numerical quality, its duration, but on the level of uncertainty you experience during that wait. Waiting 7 minutes for a train with a countdown clock is less frustrating and irritating than waiting 4 minutes, knuckle-biting, going, when's this train going to damn well arrive? Here's a beautiful example of a psychological solution deployed in Korea. Red traffic lights have a countdown delay. It's proven to reduce the accident rate in experiments. Why? Because road rage, impatience, and general irritation are massively reduced when you can actually see the time you have to wait. In China, not really understanding the principle behind this, they applied the same principle to green traffic lights, which isn't a great idea. You're 200 yards away, you realize you've got 5 seconds to go, you floor it. The Koreans very assiduously did test both. The accident rate goes down when you apply this to red traffic lights. It goes up when you apply it to green traffic lights. This is all I'm asking for, really, in human decision-making, is the consideration of these three things. I'm not asking for the complete primacy of one over the other. I'm merely saying that when you solve problems, you should look at all three of these equally, and you should seek as far as possible to find solutions which sit in the sweet spot in the middle. If you actually look at a great business, you'll nearly always see all of these three things coming into play. Really, really successful businesses. Google is a great, great technological success, but it's also based on a very good psychological insight. People believe something that only does one thing is better at that thing than something that does that thing and something else. It's an innate thing called goal dilution. Ayelet Fishback has written a paper about this. Everybody else at the time of Google, more or less, was trying to be a portal. Yes, there's a search function, but you also have weather, sports scores, bits of news. Google understood that if you're just a search engine, people assume you're a very, very good search engine. All of you know this, actually, from when you go in to buy a television. And in the shabbier end of the row of flat-screen TVs you can see are these rather despised things called combined TV and DVD players. And we have no knowledge whatsoever of the quality of those things, but we look at a combined TV and DVD player and we go, ugh. It's probably a bit of a crap telly and a bit rubbish as a DVD player. So we walk out of the shops with one of each. Google is as much a psychological success as it is a technological one. I propose that we can use psychology to solve problems that we didn't even realize were problems at all. This is my suggestion for getting people to finish their course of antibiotics. Don't give them 24 white pills, give them 18 white pills and 6 blue ones, and tell them to take the white pills first and then take the blue ones. It's called chunking. The likelihood that people will get to the end is much greater when there is a milestone somewhere in the middle. One of the great mistakes, I think, of economics is it fails to understand that what something is, whether it's retirement, unemployment, cost, is a function not only of its amount, but also its meaning. This is a toll crossing in Britain. Quite often, queues happen at the tolls. Sometimes you get very, very severe queues. You could apply the same principle, actually, if you like, to the security lanes in airports. What would happen if you could actually pay twice as much money to cross the bridge but go through a lane that's an express lane? It's not an unreasonable thing to do. It's an economically efficient thing to do. Time means more to some people than others. If you're waiting, trying to get to a job interview, you patently pay a couple of pounds more to go through the fast lane. If you're on the way to visit your mother-in-law, you'd probably prefer... You'd probably prefer to stay on the left. The only problem is if you introduce this economically efficient solution, people hate it. Because they think you're deliberately creating delays at the bridge in order to maximize your revenue, and why on earth should I pay to subsidize your incompetence? On the other hand, change the frame slightly and create charitable yield management, so the extra money you goes not to the bridge company, it goes to charity, and the mental willingness to pay completely changes. You have a relatively economically efficient solution, but one that actually meets with public approval and even a small degree of affection, rather than being seen as bastardy. So, where economists make the fundamental mistake is they think that money is money. Actually, my pain experienced in paying £5 is not just proportionate to the amount, but where I think that money is going. And I think understanding that could revolutionize tax policy, it could revolutionize the public services, it could actually change things quite significantly. Here's a guy you all need to study. He's an Austrian school economist who was first active in the first half of the 20th century in Vienna. What was interesting about the Austrian school is they actually grew up alongside Freud. And so they're predominantly interested in psychology. They believed that There was a discipline called praxeology, which is a prior discipline to the study of economics. Praxeology is the study of human choice, action, and decision making. I think they're right. I think the danger we have in today's world is we have the study of economics considers itself to be a prior discipline to the study of human psychology. But as Charlie Munger says, if economics isn't behavioral, I don't know what the hell is. Von Mises, interestingly, believes economics is just a subset of psychology. I think he refers to economics as the study of human praxeology under conditions of scarcity. But von Mises, among many other things, I think uses an analogy which is probably the best justification and explanation for the value of marketing, the value of perceived value, and the fact that we should actually treat it as being absolutely equivalent to any other kind of value. We tend, all of us, even those of us who work in marketing, to think of value in two ways. There's the real value, which is when you make something in a factory or provide a service, and then there's a kind of dubious value which you create by changing the way people look at things. Von Mises completely rejected this distinction, and he used the following analogy. He said, he referred actually to some strange economists called the French physiocrats, who believed that only true value was what you extracted from the land. So if you were a shepherd or a quarryman or a farmer, you created true value. If, however, you bought some wool from the shepherd and charged a premium for converting it into a hat, you weren't actually creating value, you were exploiting the shepherd. Now, von Mises says that modern economists make exactly the same mistake with regard to advertising and marketing. He says, if you run a restaurant, there is no healthy distinction to be made between the value you create by cooking the food and the value you create by sweeping the floor. One of them creates perhaps the primary product, the thing we think we're paying for. The other one creates a context within which we can enjoy and appreciate that product. And the idea that one of them should actually have priority over the other is fundamentally wrong. Try this quick thought experiment. Imagine a restaurant that serves Michelin-starred food, but actually where the restaurant smells of sewage and there's human feces on the floor. The best thing you can do there to create value is not actually to improve the food still further, it's to get rid of the smell and clean up the floor. And it's vital we understand this. If that seems like a sort of strange, abstruse thing, in the UK, the post office had a 98% success rate at delivering first-class mail the next day. They decided this wasn't good enough, and they wanted to get it up to 99. The effort to do that almost broke the organization. If at the same time you'd gone and asked people what percentage of first-class mail arrives the next day, the average answer would have been 50, or the modal answer would have been 50 to 60%. Now, if your perception's much worse than your reality, what on earth are you doing trying to change the reality? That's like trying to improve the food in a restaurant that stinks. What you need to do is, first of all, tell people that 98% of mail gets there the next day, first-class mail. That's pretty good. I would argue in Britain there's a much better frame of reference, which is to tell people that more first-class mail arrives the next day in the UK than in Germany. Because generally in Britain, if you want to make us happy about something, just tell us we do it better than the Germans. Choose your frame of reference, and the perceived value, and therefore the actual value, is completely transformed. It has to be said, actually, of the Germans, that the Germans and the French are doing a brilliant job of creating a united Europe. The only thing they didn't expect is they're uniting Europe through a shared, mild hatred of the French and Germans. But I'm British, that's the way we like it. What you'll also notice is that, in any case, our perception is leaky. We can't tell the difference between the quality of the food and the environment in which we consume it. All of you will have seen this phenomenon. If you have your car washed or valeted, when you drive away, your car feels as if it drives better. And the reason for this, unless my car valet mysteriously is changing the oil and performing work which I'm not paying him for and I'm unaware of, is because perception is in any case leaky. Analgesics that are branded are more effective at reducing pain than analgesics that are not branded. I don't just mean through reported pain reduction, actual measured pain reduction. And so perception actually is leaky in any case. So if you do something that's perceptually bad in one respect, you can damage the other. Thank you very much.
各位回来了啊，我们下期节目呢，还会跟大家分享更多有意思的内容，我们明天见。
下一期大学生英语在线将继续为您带来 TED Talk 的内容。
接下来您将听到的是私房拷贝。 Coming up next is home video.
Treat my pain.